Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Right now,
now's the time to do the right thing.
So usually I have some theme music going on, you all, but we don't have that today. But you know, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we're not even coming live to you from Harris Stowe State University, our own historically Black college. We are streaming through Facebook because we've had some storm damage to the studio, and hopefully you could find us after today, because I don't know how long we will be dislocated, but we're gonna make it work. We're gonna make it work. So, you know, this is the time that we connect the struggles of people on the battlefield, and there are many battlefields. And so people are fighting for education, they're fighting for health care, they're fighting for workers' rights. And all of those are connected because there's a common enemy involved. And so hearing from those people, not just in the city of St. Louis where we're based, but all over the country, and in fact, all over the world, same enemy, y'all, same enemy. Racial capitalism and then global capitalism is alive and well. But I do need to remind you that genocide is still going on in Gaza, that genocide is going on in the Ukraine. What's the common denominator there? Trump using our tax dollars. So genocide is still happening there because we got all these Negroes, including some of y'all's elected officials, that are going to Israel, being paid by AIPAC to continue the Zionist agenda there. And so we got to step it up, y'all. We got to step it up. If you believe in Palestinian liberation, we got to step it up. So yeah, we got still a 34 count convicted felon and a pathological liar in the White House. He just met with a war criminal, brought him to the shores of this country. And so we saw in living color, live and direct, how these two little dictators had come together on our dime. And so again, just a reminder so that you know that we can't give up any power. We got to use our voice, our vote, and anything else at our disposal as we fight the fascist tide that's running through this country. Today, we got some wonderful guests here because they are going to connect us to what's really happening in the Gulf area since Hurricane Katrina. And we know that Hurricane Katrina was, I think for me, one of the worst disasters in the country. And I think it's because it was televised and because it was Black people that we saw suffering at such levels that we had not seen before. And I've since then been to New Orleans. I think we weren't allowed to go maybe for the first, you know, several months, but every year after that I was going, and I was doing sort of these dispatches from Katrina, and we actually helped some of the organizers there with fundraising and organizing techniques. And so I always feel a connection to New Orleans, and sad what has happened and what still continues to happen, but realizing that it's not an isolated situation, and these disasters can be man-made as well as, you know, nature-made. And so we're going to hear today from guests who have been in some ways on those battlefields in different ways. We have Leo Carney, who's with the Mississippi People's Movement. And I told Leo that oftentimes people concentrate on Louisiana, but they forget about Mississippi, which is one of the poorest countries in the poorest states in the country by design. It's a red state. I want to mention that. And they've been busy there building a movement, particularly around some of the environmental issues. Welcome, Leo.
Thank you so much.
And we have Charles Haywood, who is, and I'm going to ask you about this. He's with Women with a Vision. And I'm going to be asking about what a feminist lens means to this whole issue. So you get a chance to talk about that. But how I met Charles is through his affiliation with the Louisiana Community Health Outreach Network and those agencies that are trying to provide goods and services to our people in New Orleans. We have Juliet Jacobs, AKA Juju, who is born and raised in St. Louis, but you know, was dispatched to New Orleans and was a school teacher there until she couldn't take anymore. So welcome, Juju. And last but certainly not least is Demond McDonald, who kind of like the reverse. He was born and raised in New Orleans, and now he's in St. Louis. But as a youth organizer, he was actually trying to do some remedies there. And I think it's going to be interesting for him because he wasn't there during Katrina. And this is interesting because sometimes our young people, when they didn't live through something, the impact is not as great. They only know what they came into. And so it is, I think it's going to be interesting to hear his perspective. So welcome, everybody. But yeah, so one of the first questions I have for folks is the neighborhoods that you are working in now, and for you, Juju, the neighborhoods you were working in and your sphere of community was a school. How are folks coping now, still coping? Is Katrina like this whole distant thing that people not have forgotten, but the way that they were living then was not much different from the way they lived before? So talk a little about and help the audience understand like what people are feeling now, what they've lost, and how they're coping. I'm gonna start with you first, Charles.
Okay, so honestly, this year makes 20 years after Katrina, and we're still trying to figure out what has happened to New Orleans. After 20 years, on the outside looking in, it appears that everything is fine, and you know the redevelopers have come in and they've spruced up the city. And I always tell people, New Orleans is now the new New Orleans. It will never be what it was pre-Katrina. We've lost our culture. We've lost some of our culture. We've lost thousands of our people. And it is just when you're there and you're living in it, you know how things just become normalized. And you just go with the flow and you deal with what it is in the present moment. But when you really step back and you take a look at what the city is and how the city moves, what the city looks like, and who's in charge, you realize that we've lost the essence in the soul of New Orleans. New Orleans, of course, has always been a big tourism spot. You know, people love New Orleans. They love the culture. They love the people. They love the food. New Orleans is hospitable. It's the South. But when you're from there, you can't help but feel like a piece of your soul is gone, if that makes sense. I'm 49 years old, so been in New Orleans just about my entire life. So to grow up and see things, how they develop and how they were, and like you just had things that were pieces that always remained the same. And lots of times I still find myself riding around and I point out, this used to be here. This was there. We used to do this. And so many staples that made that city no longer exist. After Katrina, well, when Katrina hit, you had people that were stuck in the moment of trying to survive. And then you had others who were trying to figure out how they can take advantage of the situation. What can they do to make New Orleans what they want it to be? And just putting it out there, you know, there was this vision to whitewash New Orleans. There still is that vision. We have a governor that's in place now that wants to turn New Orleans. He said it, like, he wants New Orleans to become the new Charleston. I don't know. They want it to be Charleston. They want it to be Disney World. The thing about it is that For them, it's not even about Charleston or Disney World. It's about erasing the people that makes New Orleans what it is. New Orleans was built on the culture and the lives of poor people, the lives of Black people, even the lives of queer people. These are the communities that make New Orleans and have made New Orleans everything that it is. And to this day, 20 years later, there still is a process that's ongoing to eliminate and erase people, remove us, remove the culture by any means necessary. Projects were destroyed, the housing developments after New Orleans, and when they redeveloped them into these new apartment complexes or housing communities, it was stated at that time that they would be available first come, first served to the people who lived in the housing developments pre-Katrina. That didn't work. You do have some
They
people that
always
think,
tell that
yeah,
lie.
they're gonna spin it like that, and they're gonna make everybody think that they're coming into something great, but the opportunity wasn't afforded to everyone. Then on top of that, the prices were just too high. They opened those communities and it allowed everyone else to move in. And the people who made those communities what they were still aren't back. New Orleans has become so gentrified till if you're from there, you stick to you, we become a small group of people that constantly stick together because we have to hold the culture down. We have to keep the community strong, but when you travel through neighborhoods that were once heavily populated by people of color, by brown and black people, and you go through these neighborhoods, at one point, you would never see a white person in these neighborhoods. And to this day, they're still coming in. They're still putting up houses that don't belong on the block. Like if you look at the culture of New Orleans, the houses are the same.
I hear you. I can only imagine. I can only imagine because even when I'm driving through now, St. Louis and the devastation, and I'm doing the same thing, Charles. It used to be this over there. I mean, some of the landmarks are completely gone. And for us, that means that that's the image that can never be replaced. And so whoever's coming on after us won't even know that there was an existence. I'm going to go to Juju because when we last talked to you about the school system, we talked about COVID, and we had teachers around the country who were talking about their preparation that they were given to make sure that young people, that it was a seamless kind of transition, and that the particular needs, including mental health needs, were going to be available to them. So we talked about that. What do you know since then about how that school system, which is now chartified, I call it chartified, is doing with our kids?
Well, first, let me just say this one thing is, Charles, when you spoke, I was fighting back tears, and I'm not from New Orleans. I've been there 12 years. But because I've learned to be obsessed with our culture, history, I immerse myself wherever I'm at, and they call me the New Orleans girl in New Orleans. So, I am constantly talking and learning from people from New Orleans. Like it feels like home almost more than St. Louis does to me. And to go around with them and to say, this is not what it is, that's not what that is. And it really stood out to me, and then I'm gonna get to your point too, Jamal, in just a sec. It stood out to me because the first time I ever went to a party in New Orleans, I said something about the Marigny. And a guy who's a dear friend now, he said, there ain't no damn Marigny. That's the ninth ward. I don't know what you're talking about. And I was like, no, the Marigny. And he was like, that's the ninth ward. And so I was like, oh, okay. And so I learned that even the names of the neighborhoods are different. The names are different. And that sense of community is gone, which translates into the schools, right? So, one of the biggest points that came up when I asked some of my friends, what do you want people to know about what has happened since Katrina? The neighborhood and community and the schools all came up together from each person, right? So before the charter school grab, you went to a neighborhood school. You knew your neighbors, you played with their kids, the kids went to school together, the teachers lived in the neighborhood. And now with charter schools, you have kids that are riding an hour and a half to 2 hours to get to a school, which might be different than the school that their brother or sister goes to, because it is like a lottery, a one app. They call it the one app. And it's kind of like a lottery. And so, like, I have a friend that lives in this neighborhood called Lakeview, right? It's very close to the county. It's outside of the city limits. But her child can't go to the school that's around the corner because of this one app thing. And his school is different than her other child. And they all have different off days than each other. So it creates a big problem with parents trying to juggle. Well, this kid is in this school because of the one app. And then this one is in this charter system with the one app. And their off days don't match. So now you got multiple off days you got to juggle with your job.
Wow.
On top of that, to speak on the point of the mental health, it's zip, zero, none. It's non-existent. Let's just be real. It's non-existent. Whenever everything you do as an adult, and even now, this second generation that's coming up 20 years, we're on the second generation of New Orleans children who still count time from the storm. They count time from the storm. There's not like back in 2005 or back in 2015. Everything is since the storm. It is a moment in time that they calculate from.
Right.
That's trauma.
I was going to say that's the source of trauma right
That
there. Yeah.
is a source of trauma. And it's done so much and so casually, you get used to saying it.
Yeah, it's
Well,
normalized.
was this like the storm? And then I find myself saying, well, that wasn't like that before the storm. And so that mental help has not come. We have traumatized generation after traumatized generation from the storm. And it's coming from every angle: the school, the community, the neighborhood, the streets.
The
Okay,
government.
the streets, the government. They're still getting hit from every angle, and nothing has been done when
Wow.
to help mental health. Whenever you got people that can drive down the street with you and say, I remember seeing a body there, there ain't no mental health.
Right. So
It's
that's
not.
a good segue to you, Damon, because I think you were a kid growing up, and some of the remembrances of Katrina came from your family. So you actually were going to school post the storm. What was that like, and what were you seeing when you were able conscious enough to understand like behavior in the schools, the way that young people were responding to each other? What was that like?
The thing that I noticed from when I would think about growing up in school was just how many people who are not like us that were teaching the schools. It was a whole bunch of like there was I remember when I was in middle school, there was we had a principal, and he was a very new principal, and he always talked about how he was a new principal and he came to New Orleans because he really wanted to help the kids. But a lot of times, like he would have conflicts with some of the students, like he just didn't get it. And I think that's because he's not from the community. As I became an organizer and I talked to, people who understood how the school system worked before the storm, like it was just like what Charles and Juju was talking about, like people in those communities really taught those communities. But you'll get some highfalutin person from TFA, Teach for America, who come in who wants to, help Black children.
Save the kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't get me started on Teach for America.
Yeah,
Don't get me started.
it created a real like it was a real palpable difference in like how I felt like I was able to connect with the teachers. And that created a lot of disconnect.
Well, I remember they actually, after Katrina, fired everybody, like
Yes.
8,000 people, like teachers, principals, staffing. I mean, I think a lot of people don't even know that. I mean, everybody was fired, and they said This is a time for us to start new, and all you folks are gone. Go somewhere else, but we're getting all these other folks. For you, Leo, what was the reaction of people in Mississippi who were going through the same thing and probably who didn't get half of the publicity that Katrina was getting? Because I think some of the publicity based on the, even the mainstream media helped to get some relief there, because there were mainstream like reporters was like, wait a minute, we've been here for 4 days and then nothing's coming, you know, FEMA's not here. And next thing you know, FEMA's coming. So what was it like in the Gulf area?
In Mississippi, you had a lot of wind damage in our state, which a lot of structures were completely wiped out. And we had those same issues as far as insurance companies not want to cover flood insurance at that time. But, you know, majority and, you know, some folks did get some coverage from the wind, but the flooding also impacted areas on the Back Bay, where folks, a lot of folks lost life in the Back Bay, because that storm surge came in the Back Bay and it kind of made, where both the Back Bay and the Sound met and completely wiped out a large portion of businesses, homes in Biloxi. And so we're talking about, building back. One of the main, to me, and just to me, one of the main things I saw where we were let down was by our elected officials, honestly, because a lot of them acquiesced to us being gouged by the insurance companies. A lot, and then a lot of our local mayor, even our city council, kind of failed us when it came to getting the federal dollars that we needed to build back at that time. And we're still dealing with that, right? I mean, 20 years later, East Biloxi is still dealing with drainage issues where they're digging up, you know, portions of our neighborhoods to put in new pipes because the old pipes were, flooded with dirt and stuff. So there's no water can pass through these pipes, and that creates more flooding when we have storms. And so what they've done now, like I said, they're just now getting federal money to come into our communities and tear the streets up for months and even years on end when we're looking at that. And so the infrastructure has been impacted severely, and we haven't been able to build back accordingly, in my opinion. As far as our school systems, again, in Mississippi, we haven't adopted the charter school system yet, but I can see us going in that direction, because they're already putting these grades on some of these schools. And then we've already, since Katrina, gone to what they call consolidated school districts, where you had school districts that were predominantly Black, had A grades. But when we consolidated our school districts, a lot of these predominantly Black schools are now getting lower grades because of that. And that's happening in Holmes County and other, you know, in other rural areas in Mississippi. But you can see it's almost as if they're trying to sabotage our public school system by consolidating these school districts. Like someone just, I heard someone say, you know, it's a shame that you can live in East Biloxi and have a school a block from your home, but have to be bused across town to go to a public school across town again. And it, what that does to the local school is it lowers your letter grade, because you don't have the students that you would have that could, you know, that would make the school better or have better grades. They're now taking these kids and shipping them across town to another public school. And so that's been an issue that's been ongoing since Katrina.
So I want to talk a little bit about the culture, because I've been to Biloxi, I've been to parts of Mississippi, but I've been to New Orleans, which, you know, is where some of the first enslaved people were brought. And so it just has a different kind of cultural heritage. And so when I think about the gentrification, and one of the documentaries that I saw recently, they, and you might have talked about this, Charles, where they renaming the area. So now Upper Ninth is called Bywater neighborhood. Florida Avenue is now called Bayou Bienvenue. I mean, you know, like these these names for white people, you know, who are moving in. And I think about even like, and I don't know if you all have these in Mississippi, Leo, but the social aid and pleasure clubs that have been in around New Orleans for years, like the Zulus, like the Golden Trumpets, the Buck Jumpers. I mean, are those all gone now? Are they still operating? How is that working?
As far as the culture, when it comes to the social aid and pleasure clubs, the second line clubs, we are still thriving. We'll say that. The culture has extended into Texas, however, because we have so many people, and I don't want to say that they're displaced anymore, but they've now made Texas their home. So in Dallas and in Houston, a lot of New Orleans culture takes place there. So we had 504 Day in New Orleans, and then we turned around and had it in Dallas, and then we also had it in Houston. And I think that we've been trying to do something in Atlanta. So one thing about the culture and the people of New Orleans, it will never die because it's a part of us. However, you still have entities that try to break that apart. Like I think because, and I'm tired of saying that we're resilient. Because at some point we gotta move past being re resilient. I think as Black people, we know how to survive. We know how to overcome situations. We know how to live in the moment and make the best of what we have. That's just who we are. That's it's historical for us to behave a certain kind of way. Recently, I think maybe within the past 2 weeks, like I said, New Orleans is changing. The NOPD came up with some new rules going into second line season, which the first second line of the season actually starts this upcoming Sunday on the 24th. They came up with these rules where now second line clubs need to have a $5 million policy just for the trucks and the trolleys and the floats to roll in the second line parades. Parades that are part of our culture, but they're part of our neighborhood. Social aid and pleasure clubs represent, for the most part, certain neighborhoods in the city. So when we roll and when we parade, we're going to parade in those certain communities. That's us just representing ourselves. But now we've been hit with you have to have a $5 million policy, insurance policy.
Certificate of insurance, yeah.
But first of all, it came last minute. You did this right before the season started. There's no way that anyone can afford that. But then you had there's a council actually trying to figure out where to get the policy. Nothing like that even exists, but this is just an example of the things that they're still doing to kind of shift us and minimize us and basically stop New Orleans from being New Orleans. The social aid and pleasure clubs in the community actually fought back. They went to City Hall, but because it's election time, of course, everybody on the city council backed the culture and basically told NOPD we're gonna come back to this at a later date. It's too close to the season. We can't do this now. Now, I appreciate standing up for the culture, but I'm not crazy. I also understand why it was important for y'all to step in when you did, because you're getting ready to vote in October. But culturally, some things are different. I think because it's within us, we make it what it is, and we do our best to preserve. We have, but it's an ongoing struggle. We have Trump Jr. now that's running our state, and I mentioned that before. So New Orleans has always been a targeted city because it is predominantly Black and Black ran. And even after Katrina, with the situation with Ray Nagin, and I don't want to say that he made the mistake of saying New Orleans was Chocolate City, or we're going to get back to Chocolate City, but he was telling the truth. However, that ruffled feathers, and in turn, that became the downfall of a lot of things politically within the city. Not saying that New Orleans has always been big when it comes to politics. However, we have had politicians who are culture bearers of the city and who understand us as a people. Now we have transplants, and we have new people that are coming in. They're running for positions in the city, but they don't understand who we are as a people. They don't understand that we have centuries of culture that has existed, and just because you don't understand it doesn't mean that it's less important.
or that you need to come in and make changes based off of what you think New Orleans should be when New Orleans has already been established. We're still struggling 20 years later. Now, even what Juju said about the mental, you know, just the mental health of people in New Orleans, again, we've normalized existing, but the trauma is still there. Like when you talked about the documentaries, I still have yet to watch them because I know they're going to be triggering. And with the one, I don't even know the name of it. It's on Hulu. There was so much feedback on this particular documentary. Like, you got to watch it. You got to watch it. But prepare yourself before you do. I know me personally, I'm not in the mental space to do it. I have a friend that lives in Orlando, Florida. And he texted me and he was like, I'm never spending another dime in New Orleans. And I was like, why? He was like, I just feel so bad for what they did, y'all. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he was like, I started watching the documentary, but I couldn't even finish the series. He's like, I was in tears because a lot of things were revealed that took place and we had no idea that these things were being done to you all. And he was like, I would never spend another dime there. And it's unfortunate that people have to feel that way. And like, I try my best to be a positive person. And I have to be like, well, you know, that was then, this is now. You know, you coming to New Orleans and spending your money here benefits the people of New Orleans. And we just have to be real about it. You love the culture, you love the food, you love the people. Don't let that stop you from enjoying what New Orleans is and who New Orleans is. But I get it. I haven't watched any of the documentary yet because I know I'm going to be angry. And I know it's going to bring up a lot of feelings that we minimize
what
we've gone through because it's just a constant fight for survival. 20 years later, we're still in a struggle. 20 years later, we're still pushing for things that should have taken place back then that we still don't have. We still don't have lights working on a bridge, but yet the Mississippi River Bridge had, if I'm not mistaken, it was $20 million just invested in lights to prepare for the Super Bowl. But when you're on the interstate, in certain parts of the interstate, there are no lights. You go in neighborhoods, they're pitch black.
Yeah, I hear you. You know what, Charles? I want to come back to the part about elected officials and how we can empower. But I want to hear from Leo about what culture was lost in Mississippi, Biloxi, and some of those other Gulf towns. What did you all lose culturally?
We lost a lot of our the culture that we had as far as just to be honest with you. I mean, a lot of our primarily black neighborhoods were impacted. So, like I heard someone say, you know, a lot of folk were displaced during that time. And so culture was lost because, and this is just being honest, when Katrina hit Mississippi, we had a large influx of a large immigrant population came in and filled those gaps where we were gone or folks had been displaced. And so that kind of changed the cultural dynamic of East Biloxi and I would say a lot of the coastal counties as a whole, because now we have a different demographic that's here. Now that we didn't have, honestly, that we didn't have.
And so Leo, let me just ask you about that. Well, then did that create some tensions that you all didn't have before in terms of the immigrant population and black folks?
Honestly, it was during a time where, you know, everybody was rebuilding. And so everyone was helping each other.
Okay.
So community was important. And so it was important for us to you know, to build community at that time, but from a 1,000-foot view, if you look at it from that best point, to say, okay, you know, this group was displaced. A lot of these, you know, groups in East Biloxi, historically black communities, and what our lawmakers do is they have to replace that tax base, and so they did bring in those immigrants, and a lot of those immigrants are minorities. And so I'm just telling you from a policy perspective, what I see when it comes to community block grants and all that stuff, you know, you there are certain areas in our communities that are designated for, you know, low income disadvantaged folk. And so the city gets money, they get grant money for folks who live in that community, right? And so If you're a minority and you have a business in this area, you may get a tax abatement. But in the first 5 years that you're in that business, you don't have to pay taxes until, you know. So I know the workings of how this happened, but it did change the dynamic of our culture and our community, because in my opinion, there was no mechanisms for these folks to come back home, to get back, right? Or to build back in that aspect, right? It was just, okay, well, we got to, you know, we're building back, you know, we got to keep, the city has to keep moving. We got to create a tax base. We got to get tax dollars. So
wherever that might come from.
I mean, where it comes from. So, yes. And so that did change our community. In my opinion, a lot of the opportunities that were given to other folk could have been given to the folks who have been displaced. There should have been a mechanism to hey, if you come back and help build back, we'll give you a tax break or give you a tax, something to encourage the culture to be back what it was.
So I want to talk about, because all of you all have talked about the lack of response or the cowardly response of elected officials, including Black ones. And when I think about even St. Louis, like on the second day after the hurricane, the Organization for Black Struggle sent out a press statement saying, remember the lessons of Katrina, and let's start demanding now what we want, or else we're not going to get it, and our neighborhoods will be 10 years down the road looking like they look now, because some of the lower ninth never got rebuilt. And so you just need to connect those dots with people so they see, even in the midst of you trying to struggle to deal with this, the racist insurance companies, that you still have to remember that there's people who have the power to get you relief. And if you don't make a demand, you're not going to get it. So one of the things that was a community demand is like, we want some of that Rams money. And that Rams money is the football team who left and had messed up the contract or something. And so the city got millions of dollars. And I forget right now how much, but 30 million of it is going to go towards recovery efforts. But what we've been saying is like, there's still not a comprehensive plan, not just for the short term recovery, but for the rebuilding. Because then what these folks are going to tell you is, we ran out of money. Sorry, your little neighborhood, it looks like, you know, that it does, but we can't help you now. Because, there's slow growth in the city, there's slow growth in the state, and we're just not getting the money from the Fed. So too bad, so sad. So one of the things I want to ask each of you is, how do we need to empower our communities to make those kinds of demands of our elected officials, whatever level they're on, local, state, and federal, to make sure we get what we need in a crisis situation? Because to me, 20 years later, it still sounds like it's a crisis situation. And what should we be expecting from these people and the folks who want to run and get our vote? What is our demand of them? I'm going to start with you, Juju, because especially dealing with the schools, like their school boards, what should we have been demanding of them? And in St. Louis, a lot of the kids got displaced. Some of the schools got consolidated. There was a big fight about that because sometimes there were hostile neighborhoods that were brought together. And so we said, no. Y'all obviously don't know your communities. So we were able to get some relief from some of those. But there are going to be schools that will probably never reopen based on the damage because of lack of funds. And so what is going to be the response that we have, both of any elected official or appointed official that has the power to change the way our communities are going to look like 10, 20 years from now?
Well, I would say, in a lesson from New Orleans East, because that's where I taught, was in New Orleans East. And I believe that St. Louis parents will need to get together and organize a parent group so that things do not happen to them. But yeah, like you said, demand that their schools are funded, demand that they have teachers and principals who understand their community. Because as Desmond said, that was a very devastating thing that is still happening in those schools. And the community, the school is the base of the community, to be honest. School is the base of the community. And then the businesses and, you know, which are made of the people. And like I said, looking at New Orleans and what I saw, there wasn't, or there probably was, but probably not big enough. They, you know, when you, I feel like New Orleans was the example, right? So you didn't, people didn't think that, oh my God, they're literally getting ready to take over our schools and do this, right? But that's why I said the lesson from them is to gather a large, it can't just be a handful, but a large parent group base and demand that their schools stay in their neighborhoods and that the quality of them remain high and that the people who work in those schools are not only from the area, because I think that's important. Like Desmond said, that happened a lot in New Orleans. But that those teachers are not, that those schools don't get filled up with TFA. That is the craziest thing in New Orleans. That TFA, I ran a bunch of them folks out. Trust me. I used to run them little young, rich, white kids up out of there. Because don't come in here with that. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not from New Orleans, but don't come in here with that. Because you're going to take that on, because in a year or so, you're going to be gone anyway with your student loan paid off and some experience and a certification. Okay, they getting all of this, but you want to come in here and say, oh God, I just can't do it. I don't understand this. Then leave. Leave. Go get your stuff somewhere else.
This is not the field for you. Yes.
This ain't it. And this ain't where you going to whine and cry and do all of your and half-ass and stuff and then walk out with a certification and a paid-off student loan? I don't think so.
Yeah,
we need the community to make sure that they watch those schools. The parents need to demand it. The community needs to watch it.
That's a good point. So for you, DeMond, I'm thinking about when you organizing young people, particularly when they get high school or young adult age, when they have a little bit of autonomy from parents, what can they do during these times when it looks like sometimes adults are a little bit disoriented, trying to figure out the way, but you all are feeling the direct brunt of all of this crap. And how would you say young people need to be organizing themselves?
I think that we need to be engaging in some type of political education. Like, I know we need to understand our past in order for us to move forward into a better future. I think similarly to what Juju was saying, and from what I was going to say, is that we need to organize working people in order to make these political demands. You know, the things that we're doing here at OBS, we making sure that we getting it out in our community and we educating folks on what needs to be done, because we know what the issues are. Like, our enemy or the problems are quite clear. And so being able to focus our attention collectively, I think, is the solution.
And so, Leo, I know that the Mississippi People's Movement is also not just dealing with the impact of the storm, but also some of the ongoing environmental aspects of it, because that Gulf area has long been known for racism and environmental racism and some of the toxic plants that get put there and all of that. How are you all organizing people for power?
What we're doing on the coast with Mississippi People's Movement, and I'm also the chapter leader of a group called the American Descendants of Slavery, ADOS Mississippi. And so what we do, we're a policy-driven group, and we're building coalitions is what we're doing now. We're partnering with a group right now called Hands Off Our Constitution here on the coast, which is a group of moderate and conservative. It's a moderate and conservative group who they're against fascism. And so what we've done now is to try to get a lot of our youth involved, and we do have a lot of youth engagement. There was just a 60th anniversary event for the Voting Rights Act in Gulfport that I attended a couple of weeks ago with one of our former representatives, Sonia Williams Barnes, and some others. And we had some young folks on that panel who really, really encouraged that group. And what our job is to galvanize that young base so that we can, you know, so that we can all get together, because we all share the same values when it comes to environmental justice, voting rights. What I heard from that young group, that those kids said that what they're hearing from their parents is that voting don't matter. it don't count. You know, your vote don't count. All that. And so they're saying, don't tell us that, because you teaching us that, that's going to teach us not to want to come out and vote. And so my job is really is to bridge the information gap between our baby boomers and our younger generation, so that we can, so that we, as like they said, this is what they tell me. They say, we y'all marching, everybody march. And now they feel like they're fighting as well. I know sometimes they say the older generation tells them, well, you know, y'all need to do more and stuff, but they're fighting, I guess, the fight that we didn't win. In so many words, they're fighting that same fight with healthcare. They're fighting the same fight with low wages, right? Student loan debt. And so these are some of the things I think, again, that we need to be trying to galvanize our young generation to go after. And then I feel like we can build a broader coalition and a broader base of support if we target our youth.
So I think one of the things that I'm hoping that is going on in other areas, I know we're trying to do it here in St. Louis, is build that broad coalition around fascism. And so we are part of a national group called Standing for Democracy. And so the fact that you all brought into those conservative forces, I think, is a good thing. We haven't done that yet. We're still trying to get the progressive folks together. But people see what's happening, and they know that we are unprepared for what's going on. So I think in the last few minutes that we have, I really want us to talk about what's going on with the MAGA minions and what they're doing to add another layer of burden and stress on our people with the dismantlement of some of the key agencies like FEMA, like the Department of Education, and some of the watchdogs that helped us with Food and Drug Administration. So now we got like triple, quadruple burdens that we're trying to organize our people through, and that's been extremely difficult. So Charles, the government response and all of this stuff about like pushing stuff down through the states, when they know that's because they got those people in power, and what that's going to mean for us that are trying to get empowered both socially, politically, and economically. What's going to be you all's response?
So and this is just for everyone. I think it's important, and as everyone has said about organizing, you need to mobilize, but you need to think about how people put white interests in the forefront. They're going to use climate change, these climate disasters, as an opportunity to steal resources, steal land, steal culture. Everything is for profit. And you're going to have to figure out a way to involve your policy makers. Find those are those that you can at least educate on what's going on, and you're going to have to pull them in, because you're going to need somebody to aid and be a voice for you guys when you can't actually get into those rooms. But I think it's extremely important for the community as a whole to come together. And I think someone said it, you're going to need a large group of people, not just a small group. Get everybody on board, and you're literally going to have to hold people to the fire. Elections, I don't know what it is that you can use as leverage, but you're going to have to do something to show them that you're not backing down. But what I also think is important is looking at Katrina as an example. And as unfortunate as it is, because we depend on funding for so many things, you have to figure out how to like have a grassroots movement. You're going to have to start somewhere to say, okay, we can't depend on the government for this. And we see what's happening with FEMA now. With hurricane season, and as unfortunate as it is, I don't think this administration is going to provide relief for anyone. And if I'm not mistaken, FEMA employees were switched over to work for ICE. So we have to figure out how to move around and get things done without depending on the government. And it's easier said than done. But I think when you're able to pull in everyone and find those policymakers who are going to be boots on the ground and who really understand the fight, because you're going to need them, and they're going to have to come in and they're going to have to hold their weight, however, and by whatever means necessary. My suggestion is plan now and think about things that can be done without depending on the politicians to get it done, because I don't have any faith in them right now.
That sounds very disheartening, but it's real. And so, Juju, for if we utilize what Charles is saying, and we say we can't depend on them, we got to do it for ourselves. Yet our tax dollars are going towards doing all the stuff they want to do. At what point, how do we navigate that and say, well, you know, we got to raise money for this. Well, hell, we ain't got no money now because Medicaid's being cut. Everything is going to come down on us hard. I'm talking about Black folks, because it always does. Mm-hmm. So how do we still say we're going to organize, raise our money, do what we need to do, but still hold the government accountable who's using our tax dollars?
So I think learning from pre-Katrina aid. So one of the things that a friend of mine said that she missed the most about pre-Katrina is that when they didn't have money, they ate at their neighbor's house. It was very community-based. It was basically community mutual aid, you know? And I can say that with the social and pleasure clubs, it also promotes mutual aid, right? So we're going to have to get people to understand what mutual aid is, how to build mutual aid, and how to make it function and work, right? And how that people in situations can help make it function and work. Because sometimes it's not all about money. Sometimes it's about using your resources properly, right? So a doctor or a nurse that has the ability to get to stash medication, you know what I'm saying? Like, and I'm not saying steal it, but I'm just saying there are, you know, ways that doctors and nurses get supplies and medication, sometimes through those companies that give
right samples
samples and things, you know. But those are that's the way you build some of this mutual aid. Those community gardens, those community cookouts, you know, those schools, that is how we're gonna have to do it. And right now, you know what they say, necessity is the mother of invention. Mother of
invention, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We don't even invent this stuff. This is how we used to live. Mm-hmm. And then our communities got destroyed and separated. And now it's not even inventing. We're going to have to go back to it and learn them old school ways. Mm-hmm. Go back and learn them old school ways.
Yeah.
And I can see that some of the more successful Black areas post-Katrina in New Orleans still have that connection. It might not be, and the Mardi Gras Indians are a big part of it, and the social clubs too, because they draw, they keep their communities, they were the sustaining part of those communities.
And plus they intergenerational.
They're intergenerational, and they're going to stay. You're not going to get Wild Chapultepec all the way on the Ninth Ward, because that's not Wild Chapultepec's area. You know what I'm saying? So they're going to come back, and they're built in their neighborhoods, you know? So right. Sudan Social and Pleasure Club gonna always be downtown. You know, so if it wasn't for those groups, that basically they do parties, which call them rent parties. They do parties to make their money up along with their membership. And those groups and those community artists and community foundation groups like that, that's the base of building. Because as you get one social pleasure club here and one group of Mardi Gras Indians here, they, you know, you pull them all together. I've always said, I don't see how nobody get elected in New Orleans without coming to a second line. I mean, right. You're talking about every Sunday, 500-600 Black folks.
Right.
All in one area.
Right. But it sounds like an organizer's paradise too for education. I'm gonna go to Leo. Leo, what advice can you give about how we need to be engaging, educating, and organizing people for this moment in time? Because it's so very different from anything we've been a part of.
Going on the coast and with NPM is establishing community emergency response teams within our hub, which, like I said, PM is a hub of over 20 plus organizations across the state. And so we meet regularly. We have a action team, we got a comms team, and we have a policy team, and we all get together on those different issues. And so community response teams are important. Street medic teams are important for what we're talking about right now, because what we do a lot of rapid response, and we do mutual aid work as well. And so when the tornadoes hit this year, and I think last year in Rolling Fork, we were the first ones on the ground to assess the damage, one, to bring the services to the community, because a lot of folks were out of power. And so we bring laptops and we help folks get signed up for FEMA and MEMA. And help them get signed up with the Red Cross. And so all of this stemmed from the lack of services that we were getting during Katrina. And so we said, we will never let this happen to us again, right? And so that's the way we've organized, like I said, from a grassroots level. And within, like I said, within this hub, I mean, you have churches, you have educators, all type of folks who are within this hub. And so I think that's the best way going forward. Is to build coalitions, set up these teams so where you can train the trainer at some point. Once you get trained, then you can train other folks. And that's what we're trying to do in order to build a network of folks who are in these community emergency response teams, who are getting the street medic work. We've even gotten members of our hub certified with CPR and AED training. So that they can be most effective when they're on the ground doing this work. And that translates from a grassroots level to policy, because now we identify, just for example, in Gloucester, Mississippi right now, we're dealing with a situation with a wood pellet plant called Drax. Okay, Drax is, they produce wood pellets. This company is a foreign company that's coming to our state that produces wood pellets, but to produce these wood pellets, they're deforesting the entire area in Amit County, pretty much, in Gloucester. And this pollution has been going on for some time. But what we've done is we've organized that community against Drax. We've gone to the Capitol. We protested, and we've spoken to the Mississippi Department of Mississippi Department of Environmental Quality, MDEQ. And so MDEQ just recently denied Drax a permit based on the pressure that they were getting from the community. And so what Drax has done now is they've appealed. They're going to have an evidentiary hearing in October. But again, that pressure that we put on Drax made MDEQ deny them that permit to continue to pollute that community. So that's how, in my opinion, how you affect change from a grassroots level.
We're gonna let DeMond have the last word, because people know me. I always say Black children are the canaries in racial capitalism. And so if we don't look at what's going on with them, we're gonna miss all the signs of what we should be doing. So DeMond, what do you think, when you talked about organizing, but it seems to me that a lot of, and Leo touched on this too, a lot of what is unknown is how policy is made. Understanding the systems of oppression is not just you going out there hooping and hollering in the wind. It's like, what does make transformative change? And so how do you see doing that with young people right now?
It's really difficult to say, because I think that we have to start like at a very granular level. Like we all been talking about, like it starts, you know, when I was a youth organizer, me and my friends, we noticed a lot of problems was going on in this world and nobody was really paying attention to it. And so we took it upon ourselves to sort of make some changes and to figure out ways for us to have our voices heard. And so we pulled on our elders in our communities to try to help us figure things out. And so some of the organizations that I work for really did, the elders in those organizations did well in giving us the context in order for us to make the changes that we needed to make in our communities. And so, yeah, I think it just starts with understanding that there's a problem, and then finding folks to help, you know, help the young people figure out how to direct our energy.
Absolutely. And you know, we all want to be there to do that, even though there's other loads that we are trying to juggle. But I think putting the energy and time in our young people is essential. I just want to thank all of you all for joining us today for this important conversation. I know we just touched the surface. There's so much more we could have talked about, and I still got a ton of questions. So I think I'm gonna have to bring, you know, Leo back by himself with some other of his peeps, and Charles over there with some of the folks from Women with a Vision. And so we need to let people know how folks are dealing with these issues. And this is sometimes the isolation that we feel like we're the only ones doing this, we only ones going through this. Nothing is new under the sun. Our ancestors taught us that. So we just need to continue to learn from each other. You can find this episode of Voices from the Battlefield on JamalaRogers.com. We didn't do any announcements today, so we'll add those later. But we do want to thank our guests for being here and to continue to fight for our people. But yeah, this is Jamala Rogers, your host, and I will see you on the battlefield. Okay. Yeah. Oh, there's a book. What is that, yeah, a book?
Oh, this book, ADOS, is a reparations framework. It's a guide to developing a functional reparations program. You can get this book on Amazon.com. It's a really good read. It's a good policy framework for the work we're going to have to do going forward.
Okay, look at you. That shameless plug. I ain't hating on you. Thank you. We had to bring you back to even talk about that. Okay, y'all. We out. Peace. Stop the fussing and crying.